Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. Ray Bohax here, as the introduction said, the Hot Rod Farmer, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey. As always, right, there's no other place the Hot Rod Farmer is until I go on the road with the hot wind, until we go on the road with Idle Chatter, which is going to be a new series of, I don't want to say segments, shows, I guess, within the family of Idle Chatter, where I go out on the road, and I spoke about it a few weeks ago, where I go out on the road and, interview people, talk to different key people within the machinery aspect of the industry. So I'm looking forward to trying to get that going. And right now it's a little bit of a stalemate, because with the holiday season just upon us, and this is actually when this show will be launched, it will be Christmas week. And so I'm recording it ahead of time and launching it a day or two early, because we usually launch on Wednesday, but Wednesday is Christmas, the birth of our Savior. So we're not going to launch then. We'll launch on Monday, 2 days prior. But anyway, hopefully I will be able to get that on the road with Idle Chatter up and running very shortly into the new year, as some good opportunities come about. But I'll tell you, there is a frustration. And I guess that is a frustration for everybody in business today. And it always boggled my mind when you could talk to a majority of people and they're frustrated about some aspect of life, whatever it may be, whether it's a farmer or it's a doctor, whether anybody, housewife, it's irrelevant. And then they do nothing, or society does nothing to change that part of frustration, even though the majority of the people are aggravated with it. And what I'm getting to in a roundabout way is that it is so hard today to make contact with someone, communicate with them. They want to do nobody wants to do what we used to call a belly-to-belly talk, two people talking together. Let's meet someplace. I'll come to your office. You come to my place. We'll meet in the coffee shop. Let's talk this out. Let's shake hands. Let's know what each other look like. And everybody wants to do things through email and texting, and then the... Yeah, and I know it's a frustration for you guys also. In a different aspect, you're trying to find out whether a pod is available, or find out about some seed or some fertility, or find out about a workshop, and then everything is inconclusive. Nobody gets back to you, or if you ask them three or four questions, they answer two questions. So it's like having four flat tires, right? And I'm going to give you two tires. Well, you're halfway there to getting back on the road, but you ain't back on the road yet, because you still got two flat tires. And that's just slowing this whole process down of bringing education to the farmer in every aspect. And like I said, nobody wants to talk on the telephone. No one wants to do anything. And 20 years ago, when all this stuff was coming out, they said, oh, it's going to be the communication age. Well, to me, it's the miscommunication age, because people don't get back to you, or they answer it incorrectly, or they word it wrong, so it's inconclusive and what have you. But I guess I'm, excuse me, I guess I'm on my high horse already this morning with this, but it is a frustration. 15, 18 years ago, actually 96 is when I started my writing career, so it's more than 18 years ago, but you were able to pick up the phone and call a company, excuse me, call an editor, call someone and get an answer and make a decision, start a dialogue. Today, forget about you, but you'd be better off. I feel like I'm SETI sending messages into outer space. So, but that is one thing that people can say. You could say a lot of bad things about me, but one thing people can say is that when someone gets, you know, sends me an email or calls me on the phone and leaves a message, it is a pet peeve of mine that I will not sleep until I at least respond to them one way, shape, or form, saying, hey, you know, I'm tied up. I can't answer your question right now, but I hope to get together with you on Thursday. But today's world does not do that. So anyway, the other thing I wanted to, I guess, which is a pet peeve of mine also, so like, we'll call this the pet peeve show, right? And yeah, I don't want to give you the wrong impression because, I mean, you know my voice. You know me from the show here. Maybe you've read me in the magazines or seen me on TV or go to my website and read my blogs, which gives you a better indication of who I am. So I don't want you to think that I'm this crybaby crying about everything. But I just can't understand how there is this chasm. I don't even know if it's a chasm. I don't know what it is. There's a disconnect today in society. And sadly, I'm seeing that same disconnect in agriculture, is that, you know, you go on these social media sites, and I'm on one social media, Twitter, and you know, people go back and forth on that. And to tell you the truth, most of it is 99% of it is a bunch of crap, pardon my language. And they gravitated to it. And, you know, hopefully I'm not insulting anyone. I probably am. But, you know, I tough love you guys because, you know, telling somebody what they want to hear doesn't do anyone any good. And you go to the doctor, if he tells you, well, what do you want to hear the diagnosis to be? You got a cold, but you really got cancer? And you know, that doesn't do you any good, right? You want the guy to tell you, hey, look, buddy, you got cancer. We got to start treatment. There's a very good possibility we could save your life. Instead of, yeah, you got a cold. Go home and take some NyQuil. You'll be all right in a couple of days. But, you know, to get back to this thing, I saw this post come up on Twitter. I don't know who it was. I don't believe that it was somebody that follows me. I guess they retweeted it or responded. I don't even know, to tell you the truth, how the heck that all works. It's still a quasi-mystery to me. But anyway, and this guy takes a picture of his gas, of his dashboard. It looked like it was a pickup truck, maybe a GM pickup truck, but I don't really remember. And it said, range to empty 10 miles. And he says he has 30 miles to go to the next gas station. What should he do? Well, first of all, I mean, if I was in that situation, I would not be stopping and sending out a tweet to find out what to do. At this particular point, if you've been driving for years and you don't know what to do, well, you don't need a Twitter account. And you got more problems than that, buddy. But anyway, the thing is that what I'm using this for is a learning tool and not knocking social media. But I'm using it, I want you to understand. And the thing is, what I tell people to do if they were to query me, and I do this myself, is that when I get a new vehicle, I fill up the tank and I drive until whatever to use the vehicle until the low fuel light comes on. When the low fuel light comes on, I try to get to the nearest gas station to fill it back up. All right. So if I ride, the low fuel light comes on and there's a gas station, a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles, whatever it may be, 5 miles, I take it and I fill the vehicle back up, car or truck, what have you. A farm tractor, right? Like, we don't go to a gas station, but farm tractor, fill it up and then mentally record how many gallons it took. So for instance, my Ford Fiesta, the low fuel light evokes, at it has a 12.8 gallon fuel tank, and the low fuel light evokes at around, it'll take between 9.6 and 10.2 gallons. So that means I have about 2.5 gallons left in reserve. So I do that three or four or five times when the vehicle is new, to get a baseline. So now I know that when the low fuel light comes on, that I have approximately 2.5 gallons or 2 gallons in the tank, whatever you want to say, it's actually closer to 3 gallons. At that particular point, the algorithm that all the car manufacturers use to calculate miles to empty is skewed. because they don't want you to run out of gas. And say, and then in today's society, they want to sue somebody. So, oh, I died because I starved to death because I ran out of gas. The computer told me I had 50 miles. I only had 30 miles. So if you notice when that low fuel light comes on, if you have a vehicle that tells you range to empty, you notice how precipitously the range to empty drops. You say, oh, my God, I went 5 miles. Now it's saying I only have 8 miles left instead of 20. Right? Because that's by design to spook you into getting fuel. But if you know that the low fuel light comes on, forget about the range to empty. The low fuel light comes on, then the vehicle takes about 10 gallons, and it has, use these easy round numbers, there's a 13-gallon tank, and you get 30, and you're averaging about 30 miles per gallon. You know the vehicle, go on the low side, right? Maybe you're getting 35, maybe you're getting 40, going low. Then you know that you have about 90 miles until that vehicle runs out of gas, whatever, forgetting about what the stupid computer tells you, all right? So you know that. So you say, well, I got at least 60 miles. So if you do that 3 or 4 or 5 times, and then you fill it up, run it down, fill it up, and then, you know, and know when the low fuel, now obviously if the low fuel light comes on and you drive for 50 miles, that's going to skew everything. So you throw that data out. So you know what, how many gallons it takes when the low fuel light comes on. You know how many gallons are in the fuel tank, and you know the approximate mileage that vehicle gets. All right, and then you could safely, without biting your nails, say, well, the low fuel light came on. I got 20 miles to the next town, to the next gas station. I have 80 miles worth of fuel based upon all of my testing, and you could ride those 20 miles without being white knuckle thinking you're running out of gas. And that's so the point that I'm getting at is that I can't believe that this person had this pickup truck and does not know, and he's going out on Twitter wondering what he should do about the low fuel light. I mean, so to me, that's ridiculous. That's what I'm saying. There's a chasm of knowledge. I don't want to say common sense, but there's practical knowledge. You need to be able to do it. So follow that protocol. You know, I did that with my wife's car. My wife's Escape was new. I took it, drove it, ran it down, filled it up. So this way she knows when the low fuel light comes on, she's got so many gallons of gas left. And to add to this, that usually the engineering protocol based upon fuel tank size and mileage is, it's usually, most vehicles are usually designed with a fuel tank that will afford them close to around 400 miles of range, obviously depending upon the driving, but an aggregate of 400 miles of range, 390, 400, 410, whatever. And they're usually all designed, usually, I mean, there could be an exception, that they're all designed that when some sort of telltale, what we call in the industry a telltale, low fuel light, some kind of warning, a chime comes up, that there's usually enough fuel in the tank to go between 60 and 90 miles. So that is usually, that's like an unspoken design protocol within the auto industry. So you'll keep that in mind when you are, and you know, even if your car's got 20 years old, you could still do the same thing. I mean, it doesn't have to have a low fuel light. You could say, when the gas gauge is over here and I fill it up, I know it takes 10 gallons. It's got a 13-gallon tank, so I have approximately 3 gallons left, 30 miles per gallon, 90 miles, 20 miles per gallon, 60 miles. And, you know, I travel a lot. I travel a lot in rural areas. I mean, most of you that listen to me are in rural areas, but may not travel that far. I travel for business into very remote rural areas, and they're unknown territories to me. I don't know, you know, if I'm going across Route 2 in Nebraska, I don't know how far the next town or gas station is because I live in New Jersey. I don't live in Nebraska. So the thing is, I may see a sign that says broken boat 20 miles, and I would just assume that there's gas there. But other than that, I really don't. I don't know. So I'm sailing uncharted waters. So that is very important to know that. And so, all right, whatever. I got on my high horse for today, and I thank you for letting me do that. So now it is time for our segment that we've added, and it is called Bushels and Cents. And I'm using this to truly drive home the message that success on the farm or ranch is a three-legged stool: agronomy, marketing, and machinery. And I then again think that people miss that. They're well focused on agronomy. Somebody who raises animals is well focused, you know, on animal husbandry. I'm using that term just as a collective term for the whole animal agriculture community. But they seem to forget about the machinery aspect of it. And it's just as important as the other two. And in some instances, it's actually more important. So I feel that the best way for me to represent this to you is to take real life scenarios and establish how a poor decision or inaccurate diagnosis of a machinery issue can cost your operation money. But what I want to do is, as I always say to you, instead of referencing it just in dollars, I will reference it in crop, and I'm using as my baseline corn at $3.50 a bushel. And never forget, and a lot of people forget this, it's not what you make, but what you keep that counts. There's plenty of businesses that bring in a lot of money, but they lose a lot of money because it goes out the window. They have the window open. So it's not what you make, it's what you keep. And, you know, keep that, you know, don't forget that as we go into the new year. Don't forget it. Forget about the new year. Don't forget it in any business decision. So here's our example today for bushels and cents. The pump that feeds the boom, so it's the sprayer pump, not the hydraulic pump that drives the sprayer. The pump that feeds the booms on your self-propelled sprayer is acting up, and you determine that it needs to be replaced. The new unit is $1,400. You install it, and it works fine for a while, and the same problem comes back. We've all been there, right? You do something, and you spend all this money, time, effort, and oh my God, the same damn thing is back again. You did not take the old one apart to see what's wrong. The dealer tells you that the new pump destroyed itself due to cavitation, and no warranty, buddy, because it's cavitation. It's not the pump's fault. You buy another new pump and find a collapsing suction hose. You just spent $2,800 for two new pumps, or just threw away in value 800 bushels of corn down the drain. Let this not be you. Now, keep in mind, and I did a show on this, and you could go back in the archives. I'm not pushing it, but I got 70-something shows on there. And if you have nothing to do, you'll go through them. Start at number one, because there's no repetition, and each one is an educational tool and brings value to you. But I did a show a while back about cavitation, and not only about cavitation, but I did a show about forensics. You need to be a forensic mechanic. You can't just say, and I said this many times before, you can't just go, oh, the thing failed, sucks. You know, and you can't do that. You got to take it apart, and you got to try to determine the best you can why it failed. I understand that some things cannot be taken apart, but you can't just assume that it failed for just because it failed. And that's what happened in this example. And as I said, in this bushels and cents, these are all true life examples. And so now this guy spent $2,800 on two pumps when he only needed one pump. Now, I'm not going to deny that he needed the one pump for $1,400. Right? But keep in mind that, and you know, to make this more succinct, I'm not going to write a thesis on it, but when a pump is starting to cavitate and go bad, or I shouldn't say when a pump is starting to experience cavitate, you will either hear that, you will hear it, and you'll see it on the pressure gauge, all right? So it's going to talk to you and tell you, but what happens is that, so really, in all honesty, if the person paid attention while they were operating that sprayer and saw that pressure gauge was either dithering back and forth and going all over the place, or like that, or the pump was moaning and groaning and talking to him. And sometimes I understand, on a big sprayer, self-propelled sprayer, you may not hear the pump inside. You probably won't, but you'd see the pressures fluctuating. And when if that person would have said, "Hey, something is wrong here," right, because the pressure gauge is fluctuating, something's happening, maybe I hear it talking to me, maybe I don't, they would have saved that $1,400 because they would have said, "Hey, this pump sounds like it's cavitating," instead of ignoring it and looked around. And remember, with pump cavitation on any type of pump, it could be inlet side cavitation or outlet pressure side cavitation. It could be suction or pressure side cavitation. So anytime that you're either going to starve that pump for the liquid that it's moving, right, or constipated, where it can't get out, and then you're going to end up boiling that liquid, and those gas bubbles are going to form, it's become a vapor because it can't get out, and it's going to become superheated from the impeller beating it up, is that you're going to have cavitation. And like a diesel engine with cylinder liner, you have cavitation erosion. It's hard to believe, but those little bubbles implode on the metal surface, and they eat it away. And once they eat it away, and that's how in this particular scenario, like I said, which is a true story, I don't remember from who or when it happened, I was involved with it, is that the dealer took the pump back, they sent it back, they sent it back to the manufacturer. The manufacturer sent it, said, took it apart, said, "Hey, not our problem. This thing was cavitating. This was starving or being plugged, and that no warranty." It's like saying you have an engine, you don't put oil in it, then you want the manufacturer to pay for it. So, as I say, I'm not going to beat it for 12 hours. You know, let this be you, and I hope that you're enjoying the bushels and cents. And the whole goal is to not so much teach you about pump cavitation, or we did something on diesel additives. That's an aside to this. That's an aside to the benefit of that segment on the show. But what it's, you know, so you say, "Hey man, I better check a ground circuit, or I better additize my diesel." That's aside. But the thing is that what I'm really interested in is changing your thought process and realizing that all of these things subtract from your farm's profit. And whether times are good or times are bad, why do you want to subtract from your profit by not doing things that are under your control? 99% of the stuff is not under our control. The one thing that we have under our control, we don't do. And we complain as a society, agricultural society. You could hear my frustration in my voice, agricultural society, that we complain about the crop prices, we complain about marketing, we complain about this, that, the fertilizer, weather, blah, blah, blah. We can't control all of that. The one thing we control, we decide not to even look at. So, hey, let it, enough said. All righty. So remember, I'm not yelling at you. It's tough love. So what I'm going to talk about, the topic of today's show, now that I'm 22 minutes into it, right? The topic of today's show is we're going to talk about checking a GM HEI, which is high energy ignition module. And you may say to yourself, "Well, you know, yeah, I'm going to shut the show off now because I don't want to listen to that HEI module. I don't have one of those, or I never had one of those, or I had one of those 40 years ago in the old grain truck or old pickup truck or irrigation pump, and we don't have that anymore." Well, the thing basically is that the General Motors HEI ignition system, which, as I said, stands for high energy ignition, which is not a generic term. That was actually the name of their ignition system, which I believe was even trademarked. It is the DNA for almost every ignition system today. And that's why I feel that it's important for you to understand it, because this is just like understanding soil health is the basis for a high yield. If you say, "To hell with it, I'm not going to worry about soil health. I just want to worry about the plant," right? And the thing, you're not going to get high yield, right? So the thing is that we need to back up and understand GM HEI ignition, which came out in 1975, because its DNA is found in almost every ignition system, if not every ignition system today. And plus, also, being farmers, I'm sure that you guys have a GM grain truck someplace, an old pickup truck, old C60, C70 Chevy, or GMC, right? They're very, very, very popular back in the 70s, the 80s, and into the 90s with a gas engine. It's sitting there behind the barn, and it may not run right, or it may not run, or it may run fine, all right? And that has an HEI ignition system on it. So that is why I chose to cover that topic today, all right? So let's turn the clock back, and then prior to night, and this is all going to be referenced. What I'm talking about now is referenced with General Motors, and if it's anything else, I will tell you about it, all right? And then up until 1975, GM cars, GM engines, I should say, had breaker point ignition. So did Ford, and so Chrysler. Chrysler came out with electronic ignition in 1972 or 1973, 1973, and they beat GM and Ford to the marketplace of electronic ignition. But their electronic ignition, not to knock it if there are any Chrysler fans, that it was very, very simplistic and was not not the quality of the ignition of the potential energy that the GM HEI had. So in 1975, General Motors introduced what they called high energy ignition. And that basically turned the world, the ignition world, upside down as far as how ignition system is designed and functions. And the reason that it was done was that that coincided with the advent of the catalytic converter. And the catalytic converter needs to have an ignition system that's going to be very strong to minimize the emissions that come into it, but also not degrade. Whenever you have a breaker point ignition, is that as soon as you put those breaker points in, it's like a tire, it starts to wear out immediately. So we needed they needed an ignition system that had no moving parts, and its output would stay constant over the basically the life of the system. A breaker point system, as soon as you put in and started that engine, it in theory, it started to degrade. I mean, so microscopically, but then as time went on and miles went on or hours of operation, whether it was a gasoline engine or a farm tractor, combine, or what have you, is that the ignition system started to degrade in its output. So with the emission standards, the industry could not have that, all right? So what makes HEI ignition different? Now, first of all, we have to understand how a quick tutorial and review on a breaker point ignition. A breaker point ignition has an ignition coil, and it has a set of breaker points. It has a condenser that we're talking about, the primary side of the ignition, and in every instance has some sort of ballast. And what a ballast does is that it cuts down the voltage to the coil. So now on a Chrysler product, you had a ballast resistor, which is a resistor that was on the firewall. And then on a GM product, you had a ballast wire, which was a resistance wire. And Ford also used a ballast wire. And I believe AMC used a ballast wire. It was a special wire designed with a certain resistance. So on a breaker point ignition, what would happen, and this was even on any application, right? Breaker point ignition is that the engine would crank when you went to go start it on full cranking voltage. Whatever was in the battery would be going to the ignition coil, because the ignition coil is just like a bank account, like a checking account. You got to put the money in before you could take it out. Ignition coil, even today, makes no difference. You got to put the voltage in before you could take the voltage out. So the engine would crank on full battery voltage, and then once you release the ignition key from crank to run, all right, and made no difference if it was a farm tractor with a starter button instead of an ignition key, crank to run, that the ignition coil positive side would be fed through a resistor. So let's say arguably it cranked on 12 volts, and it would run on about 7 to 8 volts. And the reason for this being is to add breaker point life. Because if you put too much energy through the breaker points, they would have a shortened life. So the system was compromised by design to have the breaker points last. So now once it started, the engine started, you are running only on about 7 volts or so, 7 to 8 volts, depending upon the resistance wire or the ballast resistor, all right? So this was always a problem. When Chrysler came out with their electronic ignition system, they did away with the breakers and used a transistorized circuit board to simulate the on and off of the breakers. You have to understand that when the breaker points are closed, the ignition coil is being charged. That's like you depositing money in a bank. And then as soon as the breaker points crack open and separate is when the spark plug fires. And the reason for the condenser was to absorb the energy as the breaker points cracked open, so they would not arc. That energy would go into the condenser. All righty? So Chrysler still used an ignition system that cranked on 12 volts but ran on 6 or 7, but did away with the mechanical aspect of the breakers wearing and needing and burning and needing to be changed and adjusted. What General Motors did with the Delco system is that they took the ballast out and they replaced the points, all right, and the distributor rubbing block cam with two different parts. One was called the module and the other was called the pickup coil. So the module, the ignition module and HEI, and it's the same thing today on any type of ignition system, the ignition module replaced the actual breaker points. The pickup coil or pole piece, whatever the manufacturer calls it, replaced the rubbing block of the points and the distributor cam that opened and closed the points. So I'll repeat that. The module replaced the breakers, became the switch on and off, and then the pole piece or pickup coil is what actually replaced the breaker, the rubbing block, and the distributor cam. And what they did is Delco Engineering designed it so that the ignition module has no ballast and runs on full battery voltage. And that's very, 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 very important that it runs on full battery voltage. So the thing is that you have a benefit right now because you have no moving parts. I'm moving my papers around here in case you hear this. No moving parts, and you're running on full battery voltage, all right? So as we said, with a bank account, the more you put in, the more you could take out. So there was no other ignition system that worked that way prior to 1975 and the Delco high energy ignition. Now, what happened, well, what I shouldn't say what happened, because it's the way a point system worked is that there was a dwell adjustment, and everybody used to have a tack and dwell meter, right? And the tack and dwell meter, so the term dwell, when it's regarding to ignition points or anything electrical, means the length of time, but when it comes to points, so we said 30 degree dwell, that meant the length of time in distributor cam rotational degrees. So 30 degrees of rotation of that distributor cam, not the crankshaft, the distributor cam, 30 degrees of rotation, all right, of that cam, if the dwell was set at 30 degrees, all right, those points would be closed. And as I said, when the points are closed, we're putting energy, electrical energy, into the ignition coil. So we're making deposits into the check-in count, all right? So the term dwell means how long in distributor cam rotational degrees that the points were closed and the coil was being charged, and that the word or the term is charged. You're not making deposits. You're charging the coil. Alrighty. So now what happened is that General Motors came up with their module design, full 12 volts. There's no ballast wire or ballast resistor, full 12 volts, cranked on full battery voltage, ran on full battery voltage, which gave it the opportunity to have much more power, all right? And then what they did was they came out with what they called an expanding dwell, whereas the Chrysler system and the early Ford electronic ignition did not have an expanding dwell. It had a fixed dwell. And what GM basically did was, instead of having a fixed dwell, which is the coil saturation, as breakers did, the hallmark of the HEI module was a patented expanding dwell. So from idle to 2,500 RPM, more or less, the dwell would expand from 5 to 6 degrees to 30 degrees. So it had an expanding dwell. And the reason why it had an expanding dwell was that they were feeding the coil full 12 volts, and even though it was designed for that, they did not want the coil to overheat, all right, overheat, because at lower engine speeds, lower RPM, historically the ignition demand is less. So they didn't want the coil to overheat, and they could have designed it so it did not overheat, but they wanted to have a coil that was going to last the life of the vehicle or life of the engine, or almost so. So what they did is that they said, hey, we're giving it full battery voltage, which is charging circuit voltage, instead of 6 or 7, we're giving it 14.6, which is what an alternator charges. We're giving it 14.6. So at idle and low speeds, we don't need to saturate the coil that long because we're hitting it with double the voltage that we would with breaker points. So what they did is that they came up with this expanding dwell theory, and that was the key. So the key to HEI was that it had no resistance, ran off a full charging circuit voltage, and had an expanding dwell. Now, this is very important, excuse me, because if the module fails in a certain part of its circuitry, and we're not going to go into there because you don't need to know that, it's just a waste of time to confuse you, the dwell will become fixed and not expand and contract when the engine is speeded up and slowed down. So where people get confused with this is that the engine will start and run, but will not run properly. It'll run rough. It'll run with the spark plug wires across. The spark plugs are fouled. And depending on where the dwell becomes fixed, the engine may stall. It may run rough. It may have no power, may backfire. And oftentimes, this leads a leads a diagnostic procedure or skew, because the person says, well, how the heck can it be the module? The engine is running, it's got spark. But because of this expanding dwell. So the module is often never considered, since it's falsely believed that if there is spark to the plugs, that all is fine. And that is not the case. So let's back up a little bit. This whole idea of running with no ballast, full charging circuit voltage, and expanding dwell eventually became the hallmark of almost every ignition, even on a small engine, like in many applications, like on a UTV or irrigation pump or what have you, on a lawn tractor, is this expanding dwell theory and running off of full charging circuit voltage has become the DNA of almost every ignition system 45 years later. And that's why I thought it was important if you understand. Now, getting back to the Delco design, but this would be applicable to every design that has an expanding dwell. And to confirm or check the dwell is very easy. What you need to do is get out your old tune-up style tachometer dwell meter, and you're going to go to the ignition coil negative side, which is the same side that you would go on to read breaker points, because the positive side is the voltage coming through the ignition switch, and then the negative side of the coil goes to the breaker points. In this particular instance, it goes to the ignition module, because remember, the ignition module replaced the breakers, and then what happens is that it turns the circuit on and off. So when the circuit is on, that's when the dwell period begins and the coil is being charged. What we would call that with breaker points, as me being an old oscilloscope man, is that points close signal, and then as soon as the dwell period shut off, would be points open. With an electronic ignition, it is called module on, which is the same as points closed, and then module off, which is the same when the breaker points open. So module on, the coil is charging. Module off is when the spark plug fires. So what you basically do is you hook up the dwell meter, you start the engine, all right, you start the engine, and you read the dwell on the ignition module. So let's say it's 6 degrees. Now you slowly raise the engine, the engine speed up to 2500, so you don't have to go much more than that. And now the dwell should expand from 5 degrees to about 30 degrees. All righty? That module is working fine. If it does not expand, then that module is not working fine and that engine will have some sort of problem. If you hook it up and then it's stuck at 27 degrees, not good, bad, all right? And it's case closed. The problem is in the module. It's not in the pickup coil. It's not in the ignition coil. It's not in the valve train. It's not in the carburetor. It's in the module. And a lot of these engines have ended up over the years started to run poorly, and they got sidelined for an ignition module because people didn't know how to check them, and they thought just because it has spark that everything is fine. And the reason why, like I said in the beginning of the show, I'm telling you this because this is the DNA, the hallmark of many, many ignition systems today. Many have an expanding dwell, and the engine will not run properly if the expansion of the dwell is wrong, and you're sitting there scratching your head. Well, it can't be ignition because I got spark. It can't be. Well, it may very well be if it's an expanding dwell and the dwell is locked. Now, point B on this is that a Delco module back then, and I'm going to say today, a Ford module, they mostly have distributed ignition, which is a different, there'll be a different show. But the thing is that a DuraSpark, a TFI thick film module, later Chrysler module, what have you, all right? A module on some small engines, all right? They'll have an expanding dwell. But the thing is that that 5 to 30 degrees of dwell coil saturation that I gave you as a general specification, which is right on the money, all right? You will find that with a lot of cheap, I mean cheap, doesn't mean cheap that you didn't pay a lot of money for it. It means it's cheap, it's junk, all right, from China or Taiwan, all right, is that aftermarket modules will have the wrong expanding dwell theory. And when I worked for the oscilloscope company, I would go out on the road and demonstrate a scope. A guy would bring a car in, this was years ago, and the thing would say, well, it was running lousy, or it didn't run, it was a no start. I put a module on it, still runs lousy. And I'd put on the scope, and in 2 seconds I would see it. I said, your module is not good. It's defective. The dwell is stuck. It's only going from 15 degrees to 21 degrees. It's too much dwell, too much coil saturation at idle, and not enough at high RPM. And the guy would argue with me, and it would be some sort of aftermarket module. So go get it. Let's go get a Delco module for this, right? And if I'm wrong, I'm paying for the module, right? So I'll shake the guy's hand and say, look, many times, say, look, I'm wrong. The module's bad time was $30 or something, 40 bucks. I say, I'll pay for the module. Here's my hand, shake it. If I'm wrong, I'll pay for the module. So we'd go and get a Delco module, put it in there. I never gave anybody any money in my whole career. All right, so that's how surefire. So keep in mind that if you get a new module, all right, if you get a new module, that you need to be concerned with that dwell period, because you'll really be chasing your tail. You'll say, well, now it runs, but it runs crappy, or it stalls, or it backfires. Well, it's because that dwell period is wrong. And to recap, it's very, very, very simple to check it. What you basically do is you hook up your old dwell meter, get it out of your toolbox, you go to the negative side of the coil, you start the motor up, and you run it, and then you go from there, and then you raise the RPM up, the dwell should expand, and on a Delco-style design, go from about 5, 6, 7, 8 to 30 degrees. Then the thing, you know, and you know what you could also do with any of your other older motors, you could check the dwell. It's very, very simple. Check the dwell. Now, there are other ignition systems like Ford DuraSpark. I had a gentleman contact me a while back. He was from up in Canada. I forgot his name. And he's a listener to the show. And he had a problem with a truck he used as a nurse tank truck for the sprayer. It was an old Ford and started to act up. And it wasn't a comedy of errors on his part. It was just a comedy of things. And then what happens, he went to town and bought a new module, but it was an aftermarket module because he couldn't get a Ford one. And then he had a whole bunch of troubles, and then he finally got it figured out. And actually, the old module worked better than the new one. And I don't remember what he found with that particular truck, but keep that in mind. So it's a good idea for you to be familiar with that. So the thing is that an aftermarket module may or may not have the same coil saturation that was that system was designed for. And if that happens, then all bets are off as far as how that engine is going to start and run. So the thing is that, like I do want to say to you, is that even though I referenced it off of General Motors, and you know, we'll see the same thing. You'll see the same thing in any part of agriculture. You could have a hydraulic pump that may be based upon an original John Deere design, or you may have a planter that's, you know, a double disc opener seed meter type of planter that could be based upon somebody else who brought that to market, whether it's a, you know, IH or John Deere or Case or what have you. So the thing is that lots of times what will happen is that you'll have one company just have such a breakthrough in that particular technology that over time everybody adapts a slightly different version of it. Then you know what happens with seed, right? Some company comes out with a certain genetics, and you know, and somebody else starts to copy it or what have you, and say, well, we're going to do the same thing. Well, that's a good idea. All right, that's a good idea, and let's try to make it so we're not infringing on their patent. And actually, believe it or not, Ford did that with their thick film ignition. And what they did is that they copied a Delco HEI module, but what they did is they had the module on the outside of the distributor instead of on the inside. And whereas a General Motors pickup coil, which remember the pickup coil replaced the rubbing block on the points and the distributor cam, whereas the General Motors pickup coil created a sine wave, and then the sine wave went into the HEI module and was converted to a square wave, a digital signal. What Ford did is they copied the module with the expanding dwell period, and what they did is that they went and they have a more complex pickup coil. They call it a PIP, profile ignition pickup. And this, I'm talking back with thick film. I mean, with the distributed ignition, this doesn't hold true. But with the thick film system, TFI system, it was the gray module on the side of the distributor housing, not the module that was bolted to the fender box. That was a DuraSpark, completely different system. But what Ford did is they converted, they had the pickup coil create a sine wave, all right, a sine wave output, and inside the pickup coil, they had what's called a Darlington amplifier and a Schmidt trigger. A Darlington amplifier takes that sine wave and increases its magnitude, like putting it on a copy machine and blowing it up and making it bigger, all right? So because the bigger it is, the easier it is for them to work with it, to chop it, what they call chop it, and then the amplified signal sine wave from the pickup coil. What the sine wave from the pickup coil went into the Darlington amplifier, Darlington, like Darlington Speedway, capital D. It was the gentleman's name who I invented the circuitry, Darlington amplifier, and then it went to a Schmidt trigger, which was another person's name, and the Schmidt, I think it's S-C-H-M-Y-D-T, Schmidt trigger, would take the sine wave and then what we would call in electrical engineering, chop it and make it square, and then the module would read it. So what happened was that it was not a patent infringement on General Motors, on Delco, because General Motors did that in the module and Ford did that in the pickup coil, all right? But it's the same, you know, hey, they got to the same place. They just said, well, let's move it over here and we'll do this over here. Then it's not a patent infringement because we don't have a Darlington amplifier and a Schmidt trigger in the module. We have that divorce from it. But anyway, the take-home message here is that you're working on the farm and you're working on gasoline engines and you're working on a system that has an electronic ignition, which is almost everything that you would have on the farm today. Me being a dinosaur, I don't even have any points engines on the farm anymore. But the thing is that what you will do is that you need to understand that just because that system is creating a spark and arcing the spark plug does not mean that it is functioning properly. And it may have a low output or too high an output, or I'll just use the word, the wrong output. So that is why you need to understand. And as I said in the beginning of the show, is that they, meaning the industry, has basically copied the Delco HEI ignition. So there's a lot of that DNA still floating around all over the place. And believe it or not, a lot of motorcycles even have that had a distributor or what have you, had that type of that expanding dwell and went to put my tongue back in my mouth, no ballast, full charging circuit voltage. So if you have any questions or any concerns with this, as I always like to say, do you all want to open up a dialogue on it, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And, you know, everything that I always give you on every one of these shows has value, and I'm not tooting my own horn, has value, but lots of times you need to back up, because if you don't back up and find out how you got there, there's no foundation. And that's what I wanted to do with this show, is give you a foundation. I don't want you to close your ears and say, well, I don't have an old Chevy truck. What the hell do I give a damn? And I hope you understand that foundation, and that's what was the basis, and I'll use the word humbly, of my success in it, because in my career was that I always took the time to understand the foundational aspect of it. Because if you understand the foundational aspect of something, well, maybe the voltages may be a little different, maybe this is different, or the mechanical aspect of it is different, but you could recognize and figure out what's going on. If you understand how a carburetor works, then you could take almost any type of carburetor apart and identify, okay, this is the main metering circuit, this is the power circuit, this is the idle circuit, this one is using a power valve instead of metering rods, this one is doing this, what have you. So the thing is that, you need to have that foundational thing. And so many times in the Idle Chatter podcast is I am establishing a foundational theory to you that you need to take and apply to different aspects as they come up in your farm. And same thing like plant physiology, crop nutrition, right? Crop nutrition. You may say, well, soybeans like this more than corn, and corn likes this more than sugar beets, or sugar beets don't like this and corn likes it, what have you. But you have to understand the foundation of nutrients in the soil. And then if you have those nutrients in the soil, then that plant is going to want different things. But you have to have that foundation. And that's really what it's all about. And, you know, in talking about foundations, it is now time for our toolbox test. And we are on test number 2. And we're on question 5, which is the last question on test number 2. And all of these tests are on my website, as I said. And I'm starting to see that you guys are going back in the archives of those and taking those tests. And they're learning tools. They're not meant to embarrass you. They're not meant to do anything. They're a learning tool. All right, so we're on question number 5 of test 2. But as we were talking a minute ago, is that about plant nutrition and nutrients in the soil, is that the toolbox test each week is brought to you by Agro Liquid Fertilizer. And they are perfectly calibrated crop nutrition. They are high efficiency, like HEI ignition. I always like to make an analogy to the fertility to what I'm talking about in the show. I can't always do it, but it's just like HEI, right, has we just discussed, has full charging circuit voltage and expanding dwell, right? All right, that's what Agro Liquid is. It's high efficiency. It's the HEI of crop nutrition. And be through that, through those, that formula and that efficiency, you will be able to easily hit your yield goal, hit your target, because you're giving the plant what it wants. So I'm a hot rod farmer. I'm an engine guy. I'm not an agronomist, but I will challenge you. Go to the Agro Liquid website. If you were to show over the wintertime, go talk to the Agro Liquid representatives. Go into it with open eyes, just like GM did with HEI, right? Say, hey, we're not going to have breakup points anymore. We're not going to do like Chrysler and have a fixed well. We're not going to run it off of 6 volts. We can get rid of all of that stuff that's not advantageous with breakup points, and we're going to come up with a whole new design. And that's what you do. Go to the Agro Liquid booth, talk to the Agro Liquid people, and I would be very surprised if you did not become an Agro Liquid farm. But we have to do one other thing before we read our test question. And I think you all know what that is, right? It is time for my friend Tex Rabinowitz from Ripsaw Records to sing his song as the intro and give you a time, a few 20 seconds, to put on your thinking cap as we listen to the Hot Rod Man on the Hot Rod Farmer Show. Hit it, Tex.
I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can.
All righty, we're ready for our question now. Tex is out there and he's going after that hot rod mama. We don't know what she looks like, but I'm sure she must be pretty hot rodding, right? All right, so now we're on question number 5. And as I always say, don't be concerned with it's A, B, C, or D. Be concerned with what the answer is. Okay. You are reading a learning series article on the Farm Machinery Digest website. That's my website, in case you don't know. And the article is about subharmonic stress relief of metals. You learn of the acronym HAZ, capital H, capital A, capital Z, but you do not remember what it stands for. At coffee the next day, you ask your farmer friends and they claim the following. So you read an article on my website. I have a learning series article. I have getting to know, and I have a lecture hall series, and I have the Hot Rod Farmer Minute. So if you go to the learning series, currently I think there's about 60 different short articles for you to read. And this is an article I have on subharmonic vibrational stress relief, all right? So Farmer A says that we're talking about, what does HAZ mean? H-A-Z is in zebra. Farmer A says that it is the heat-affected zone when working with metal. Farmer B says that it identifies a hazardous gas that comes from the steel if you weld on it. Farmer C thinks it is a type of metal. And Farmer D says that it's something that the hot rod farmer just made up. So alrighty, that Farmer D, he and I, we gotta have a little talk one day, because we don't make up anything here. So Mr. Farmer D. Alrighty, so you have to tell me what H-A-Z is. And we have to go from there. Right now what I have to do is I am looking for my special delivery letter, which is not good. I don't know how I got all these papers here, and I don't have my special delivery letter. But in the meantime, I will tell you that special delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag, the company that was founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. And Harvey dreamt. He dreamt so hard. He was a dreamer like I am. And I'm not saying I'm Harvey Firestone, but I guess we share that we're dreamers. And he dreamt of putting rubber tires on farm tractors to give the farmer the benefit of having a smooth ride, less compaction, and to be able to go in the field faster and get more acres done. That same mindset, that same passion for the farmer and agriculture and taking engineering and blending it and bringing it to value on a farm is still alive at Firestone Ag today. And you could see it. Don't believe me. Look at their 23-degree tread bar design, their AD2 technology tires, which is the IF and VF, and now currently the Firestone of replacement tracks. And that's Harvey's track. So if you need a set of tracks, do yourself a favor. Look at what Firestone has to offer, then make your decision. And remember, the soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. So we have a question here, and it came in the other day, and I'm probably going to kill the guy's name as I did. He contacted me. His name is Mr. Simon. I'm pronouncing it Cowenberg. If you recall, a few shows back, he wrote in about a Ford diesel pickup truck that he had a problem with it starting, and I got together with him some emails, and he had a bad glow plug relay, and he put new glow plugs in, and it started for a while, and then ended up having the same problem. But anyway, so that was a letter a few weeks ago, if you remember his name, and I believe he was in Ontario, Canada, I think right in the Windsor area, right across from Detroit, but I may be wrong. So I always like to try to find out where the people are, because it makes it more interesting. I'm interested in them, and also there are certain peculiarities for a particular area that would, you know, for instance, if you're in Colorado or Montana, high up on a mountain, that would show itself, that wouldn't be showing itself at, you know, someplace out in the desert. So, you know, I love to travel, and I, you know, very interested in finding out where people farm. But anyway, so Mr. Cowenberg writes, and I communicated with him with this already and got back to him, so he's not waiting for to listen to the show to find out his answer. But I felt that his question was excellent, and there's probably a lot of people would have the same question, so I wanted to cover that. So he writes, "Hi, Ray. I was talking to the mechanic at the farm where I work about changing the engine oil on the S670 combines before they get stored for the wintertime. He says, meeting the mechanic, it's better to leave the old oil in the engines over the winter so that they don't accumulate any moisture in the fresh oil. I would have thought that it would be better to put fresh oil in the engine before being stored for a while, because then engine oil won't be acidic and have more additives still in it. Curious what your thoughts are on this. Thanks, Simon." Well, Simon, you are, as I told you in your email, you're 110% correct. If you have any engine oil in anything, whether it's a small engine or in a combine, it could be in a lawnmower, what have you, and it has some use of consequence on it. I'm not saying it's got you know, 1 hour, 2 hours. If you drain it every 50 hours, has 10 or 15 hours on it, you know, a quarter of the way through its life cycle or what have you, it is always best to put the machinery to bed for the winter with clean oil in it and fresh oil and a fresh filter. And the reason being exactly what Simon said is that the oil is going to pick up impurities, its additive package is going to become degraded, it is going to hold moisture, and it is going to become acidic. And then what's basically happening is you're having this acidic oil, this compromised additive package, could have some fuel in it, could have a whole bunch of other things blow by in it. All right, this acidic oil sitting in the crankcase and touching all of the parts where it is on the engine and causing corrosion, rust, and deterioration. So the best thing is that you want to put the engine to bed, and I do this on my farm, whether it's not so much with the farm tractor because I use it to plow snow in the winter. So I go through a normal cycle with that. But if I'm near an oil change cycle, even if it's early, I will change it before the winter because the tractor, if we don't get snow for 3 or 4 weeks, it's not going to run. So I do follow that same thing. But my lawn tractor, my small engine, my pressure washer, my generator, all right, they all get put to bed with fresh oil in them so that it doesn't have that acidic effect, and the full anti-corrosion additive package is still there working to the best of its ability. Now, to the mechanic where Simon works on his farm, his idea about the moisture certainly has credibility to it. All right, I'm not going to deny that. But the fact of the matter is that the fresh oil with its anti-corrosion inhibitors will be much, much better positioned to deal with some moisture that migrated in from temperature change over the winter or humidity. And then it would be if it is depleted, meaning depleted slightly or worn out and polluted oil. And then once that engine starts and gets hot, you will boil that moisture off. So the mechanic does have a valid point with that. But what you're doing is by not wanting to get a little bit of moisture in fresh oil. So if you think of fresh oil, it's like a healthy plant, right? A healthy plant, if it's got good nutrition and everything, it could withstand stress much better. All right, a healthy person could withstand a cold much better. You get an elderly person, they get a bad cold, turns into pneumonia, they die. So that's what's happening with the oil. So the thing basically is you want to put it to bed with fresh oil. The little bit of moisture that will be wicked into that oil will not be of detriment because the additive package will be strong and the oil will not be acidic. And then once the engine starts and gets hot, you will boil that moisture off in short order and it'll have no problem whatsoever. All right, so thank you very much. I thought that was a great question. Simon, I want to thank you, and I'm sure a lot of people out there listening have the same thoughts about it. And you know, you can make a convincing argument either way, just like the mechanic did. I mean, like I said, convincing argument either way. I'm not knocking him whatsoever, but you have to, you know, you have to choose, for lack of better, you have to choose your poison. And it's so the thing is that you want to get that acidity and polluted oil and depleted oil out of the engine. All right, so back to our question now. And we will give your answer, and we are getting ready to close the show out. So, and basically, in essence, you remember when you're talking about metals, what is the HAZ? H is in Harry, A is in Apple, Z is in Zebra. So Farmer A knows the answer. HAZ refers to the heat-affected zone. This is the area that becomes elevated in temperature when a metal is welded on, cut, or machined. The uncontrolled cool down rate in the HAZ induces thermal stress and either weakens the part or causes distortion. So when you're welding on something or cutting where the majority of heat is on that workpiece, is called the heat affected zone. And I think about 7, 8, 9 months ago, I did a podcast, if you look back in the archives, on understanding thermal stress in metals. And we all suffer the wrath of thermal stress in metals, but we don't realize it, and we just write it off to, oh, damn, the spring broke, or the bracket broke, or the valve spring broke, or what have you. So you may want to look back in the archives for that show, and it's a whole show on understanding. There's two types of stresses found in metals, thermal stress and mechanical stress, and thermal stress is by far the most detrimental. So listen, I want to thank you so much for listening. I said in the beginning of the show, it's Christmas week. Even though people will listen to the show afterwards, if you listen to it afterwards, I hope that you had a blessed Christmas and celebrated the arrival of our Savior as a baby, Jesus Christ. And if you listen to this on a hot July day, well, so be it. I hope that everything is going well. And thank you for listening. Again, if I didn't already say it, and please know the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. It's time for me to hit it now and to get out of here and roll some smoke, roll some coal, right? Take care. Have a blessed day.